And let's make a couple of announcements first in terms of what we're going to do. We are not going to hear HB 3367. It turned out there were some relating to cause problems and getting amendments, so that's we may find where we think we were going on that bill at a different time if we find a different vehicle. We're going to hold over HJR 18 until Monday. We don't have very much of an agenda on Monday, only 20 or 30 bills at the moment. So we should have lots of time to deal with that one.
What's that? Pajama party?
Hmm?
I'm sorry, Chair. Pajama party?
We've been thinking about how to deal with the month of the merry month of May and the number of Senate bills we think will be coming over. I think if we can work it out after next week, we'll do the same thing we've been doing with the subcommittees. But after next week, if we can work it out, I think we should try, if it meets most of the people's schedule, to go to three full meetings a week. A Monday meeting and a Friday meeting from 3 to 5 and a Wednesday meeting from 6 to 8 if it doesn't destroy too many people's schedule. I'm sorry, Representative Gelser is not here to hear that, but it will also relieve the subcommittee, the members who are only subcommittee members, from having to join with us. So can I have some comment on how it works with your schedule? If not, we'll do something else.
Is there a reason why you don't 3 to 5 on Wednesday?
Yeah, there are people on the Monday and Wednesday schedule that have other things that conflict with Monday and Wednesday. So we thought we could mix them on Monday and have them with us on Wednesday, where we might lose somebody else on Wednesday. I was just trying to equalize it for people that had problems. Yeah, the obvious preference would be Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 3 to 5. I think it doesn't meet schedules very well. I think that's... Do I hear any sense?
Mr. Chair, could you repeat those times?
Well, the preference would be Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 3 to 5. But my understanding is there are some people that have commitments in the middle of 3 to 5 on Monday and Wednesday. So the thought was that we might miss some on Monday... in the Monday session, and if we have an evening session on Thursday, on Wednesday, we might miss some others, but that we would basically have most of a quorum most of those days. But please let Sandy know if that causes a problem. And who do we have? We don't have Representative Flores and Representative Gelser. We can talk to them individually. And if it's a problem, we won't do it. We have next week where we'll be doing it the regular way with subcommittees. I'm just worried about us trying to figure out how to deal with the workload that I expect we'll have. Okay, let's go. Can we start with HGM 23? Let's
see who's signed up, Mr. Chair. But I can get it started.
Open a public hearing on HJM 23.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. HJM 23 is a memorial that urges Congress to reauthorize the state Children's Health Insurance Program, otherwise known as SCHIP, in a timely manner. You also have a copy of the bill, preliminary SMS, and the memorial. A dash one amendment to the memorial that I got late today. It looks like it has some key changes to it, and I believe the individual who signed up to testify can speak to the amendment also, Mr.
Okay. We'll call Janet Bauer.
Hi. Good afternoon, Representative Greenwick. I'm Janet Bauer with the Oregon Center for Public Policy in Silverton, Oregon. We are an organization that supported the introduction of this memorial. We also are proposing the amendment that would reflect the progress that Congress has made in taking the first steps to reauthorize the state children's health insurance program. And that is both houses of Congress have approved a $50 billion reserve fund for that purpose. So we thought that it would be helpful and of some encouragement to our delegation to reflect the step that they've taken in the memorial.
And that's what the Dash One amendments do.
It would add the indication of the reserve fund or the $50 billion and direct our delegation to deliver on that, as well as provide Oregon with more tools to help reach more uninsured children.
Are there any questions? You all have the amendment in front of you. Take a minute. Reading. Okay.
I'll move it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We're not in a work session. Excuse me.
I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on HJM 23. Nope, that's not right. Yes, it is. Right.
Yep.
HJM 23.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
I would move the Dash One amendments to House Joint Memorial 23.
Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the Dash One amendments? The Dash One amendments become a part of HJM 23.
Chair, I would move House Joint Memorial 23 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation as amended.
Is there any discussion? Darren, would you call the roll, please?
Hi.
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 Hi. HJM 23. Motion carries. HJM 23 will go to the floor. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
This next one.
I have two requests to carry it to the floor, so let's have co-carriers, Representative Kotek and Representative Gelser.
Representative Kotek can carry, that's fine with me.
No, I want rock, paper, scissors.
My kids always played rock, always played rock, paper, scissors. My oldest daughter always won.
Yeah.
No, let's both carry, that'd be fine. Two brief statements.
Sounds good. Sounds fine. Okay. More than merry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know what to do with all the material today. Gather them up later. Close the public hearing on HJM 23. I'm sorry, the work session on HJM 23. Well, let's go in order. Let's, at least for right now, let's take HB 2800, which comes to us from the Policy Committee with Representative Flores carrying it. Russ.
Indeed.
I'm sorry. Late in the week. I've got a work session on HB 2800. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2800 has come to us to consider moving the landscape a little bit, giving prescribing authority to certain licensed psychologists. There have been a number of meetings at the direction of Chair Kotek between the psychiatrists and the psychologist groups to come to some consensus. While there was a lot of vigorous debate and interesting dialogue, on this particular issue, and there was a considerable amount of ground covered in this whole discussion about specifically about the clinical experience for prescribing authority for licensed psychologists and other areas. There was never consensus to be reached. Consequently, we did move. Can you move? I don't think we did.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The dash.
We did do this.
The dash two. We had drafted the dash two amendments, and which set forth, and it gave some and it took away some from of the discussions that were held. And we did pass the dash twos in the subcommittee, and that's about where we are as we bring this forward to the full committee for consideration.
Could you just briefly tell us what the dash twos do for the members who weren't a party to that discussion?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, can we just say what the whole bill does?
Because okay,
I think it was pretty much a replacement. So.
Okay, please do.
Thank you. And again, authorizes the State Board of Psychologist Examiners to grant prescriptive authority to certain licensed psychologists. And there would be standards that would be adopted for psychologists seeking prescriptive authority and to limit the drugs that they might prescribe. There was, going back to the discussions that were had between the two fields, there is a currently a great collaborative effort between psychiatrists who do have prescribing authority, psychologists, and physicians. Primary care physicians. So there is a great collaborative relationship in those three fields. So this does talk about collaboration and gives definition to what that means. Distribution of a drug, the definition of a drug, and gives other definitions, impaired psychologists, definitions of what would be describing an impaired psychologist. And what the definitions of prescribing authority and prescribing the psychologist would mean, and limits the formulary list. It puts within the State Board of Psychologist Examiners a certification process that the licensed psychologists have to meet. Minimum of 2 years post-licensure clinical experience with an inpatient or outpatient healthcare setting. That was a very pivotal piece of the discussion. The context and the framework of where that clinical experience would be had. That their master's degree requirements in clinical psychopharmacology and an accredited institution. The length of the supervision has completed at bottom of page 3, line 28, that they have completed no less than 12 months and no more than 24 months an integrated supervised clinical experience of at least 250 hours, including differential diagnosis and implied pharmacological management of patients in conjunction with their specialty. And does addressed certification again in psychopharmacology ascribed by the board rule. I'm just trying to hit the really salient points. There is a lot of information in here, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair.
I think you have done a great job.
And again, this was an area that great passions on both sides, but just as certain nurses had been given prescribing authority a few years ago, and just as optometrists and ophthalmologists had that dialogue a few years prior even to that, it is a paradigm shift, and the whole purpose here is to help provide additional resources. particularly in rural areas, for helping those who do need mental health assistance and some prescribing opportunities.
Thank you very much. Representative Bonamici, you were a no in the subcommittee. Would you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just about to raise my hand and ask if I could make a few points for the members who weren't involved in all of our hearings in the subcommittee. This is another one of the thick file folder bills. I did vote no.
There's a big file folder that says vote no.
I did vote no in the subcommittee and will continue to be a no vote on this. And I've given a lot of thought to it, done a lot of reading, and talked to a lot of people. And I'll tell you the primary reasons why. Although I certainly acknowledge the concern, the lack of health care for many people, especially in rural areas, this is not the right way to address that. I talked to people about the level of medical education that's required for this, because you look at the difference between psychology being a social science and psychiatrist being more of a the medical training is just completely different. It's unclear that there's adequate supervision in the program. It's unclear, based on some of the information that I have, that the program is adequate for the complexity of the medication and the health problems. There are existing programs like the physician assistant or nurse practitioner that already set out a structure for prescribing medication, and this creates something different and importantly is under the oversight of the Board of Psychology Examiners, which does not have the background. I'm trying to read my cryptic writing here. There was a lot of opposition by people with expertise, and I don't think this is a turf war, although some people contend that. There's a letter in here from a psychologist who says, by the time physicians start their practice and begin prescribing, they have been immersed in science and culture of medicine for a minimum of 6 years, often longer. Even with the training proposed in this bill, the psychologist is not prepared to enter the prescribing world. And that was from a psychologist who says this is not a fight over territory but about public safety. This is imposed by the Oregon Pediatric Society joining the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, who are opposed to this bill. It's their concern that allowing psychologists to prescribe psychotropic medication will expose children and adolescents to inadequate care. And I know there was a lot of negotiation in coming back with a set of amendments, especially dealing with the children patients. But frankly, by the time you look at all the different steps in that section, it seems duplicative, and I sort of think, why bother if the psychiatrist is and the practitioner, the pediatrician is involved in all the steps? It just adds another layer that I don't think should be there. And importantly, I know Representative Forrest brought up the issue about rural health care, and we've heard a lot. We had our satellite hearing, and yes, there's an incredible need for more access to health care in rural areas. That's not what this bill does. Nothing in this bill requires prescribing psychologists to go to rural areas, and I don't think that they will. I think that's a more complex issue than if we allow psychologists to have prescribing privileges. They're not necessarily going to go to rural areas. So overall, in sort of doing the cost-benefit analysis, I thought that the potential for harm outweighed the potential benefit. I think what we really need to do is figure out a way to get more psychiatrists, more people into psychiatry, more health care, overall health care in rural areas. This bill does not do that. And just one more comment I wanted to make about the children, which because I feel so concerned about that particular issue. This is from somebody who's, I believe, the head of child and adolescent psychiatry and teaches at OHSU. Since the child psychiatry part is very awkward and suggests that they might think that if they're not competent enough to do the work, they need supervision on every medical decision, and if they need that level of supervision, they're not improving the system. So those are my main reasons after much thought of voting no on this, and be happy to answer questions if I can, although it's...
Representative Kotek, didn't the pediatricians back off after the day?
Where did they end up?
Mr. Chair, just to make clear for the record, we did not have consensus with the psychiatrist, so I don't want to give the impression. They did participate in the work group. We also had a nurse practitioner and a family physician in that work group. I don't believe the Pediatric Society, they are still in opposition. And I think both representatives are correct in that this is a major step in a direction that actually a couple other states have done. We did not, to my remembrance here, a lot of concern from those other states. So I'm not aware of concerns that have arisen in a couple states who do it now. I think we've put in a lot of processes and hoops to make sure that the right people with the right training are attempting to do this. I'm not anticipating a flood of folks in the psychological profession even wanting to attempt this, primarily because they might not even believe in prescribing as something they want to do as a psychologist. But for that small number who are working in communities that can provide that better access to care in the sense that they don't need to go to three or four practitioners to get what they need, I think that's what this is about. There is going to be a fiscal on this because we're setting up a new process in the board of psychologist examiners, so it does have a referral to Ways and Means. I think we have some benefit here, and I think I'm opting on the side of this is something we should try, and I think we've put enough in here to provide enough safeguards, I believe.
And the psychiatrist did testify that that with the amendment, the bill was a lot better than it was originally,
yeah,
but they were still opposing it.
Yeah. Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Richardson.
I have been lobbied on this by both sides, and it's obviously.
I mean, everybody has to get rid of it. You'll have a free moment.
And I think that when that happens, and I want to know why, you know, and so is it the psychologists are not as bright as psychiatrists? I mean, psychiatrists are MDs, which means you don't just get taught in pharmacology, but you're taught in emergency procedures and having babies and all those things which have nothing to do with this. And so the mere fact that they're a psychiatrist does not necessarily mean that they are magically knowledgeable about pharmaceutical drugs or psychotropic drugs, although I'm sure they're very knowledgeable about it. But the real question is, should that ability expand to others? I go to the actual bill, and it says that for this to happen, a licensed psychologist has to hold a valid certificate of prescriptive authority, has to have a master's degree in clinical psychopharmacology from an accredited institution. The degree must include training in physical assessment, pathophysiology, psychopharmacology, and clinical management sufficient to prepare the applicant to safely prescribe for individual patients. You have to have 250 hours, including differential diagnosis and applied pharmacological management of patients. You have to pass a national certification examination in psychopharmacology as specified by the board by rule, and they have to have 50 hours of continuing education every 2 years thereafter. To me, it sounds like there's reasonable preparation for someone to assume a very narrow area of expanded practice, and so it makes sense we gotta go.
Other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Maher.
I obviously have been lobbied by both sides. Don't find that surprising. But I think there's a larger dynamic at work here, and there's a Senate bill that hopefully will be coming over, Senate Bill 717. I think it's 717. And it talks about a process that we can look at going forward to address these expansion of scope of practice questions that apparently continually come to the legislature. And as Representative Richardson described, I'm comfortable enough with the changes in this bill with the 12, because originally it was 12 months, and expanding it to 2 years, which is significantly better. But this Senate bill gives an opportunity for us to look at a different process for how to deal with scope of practice issues that may be more thoughtful and bring some different people to the table looking at some very specific questions. So even if we pass this out and we see this other bill and say that may be a better process to address a scope of practice issue, that theoretically on the Senate side they could stop and say, no, this needs to go through this process. So today I'm supportive of it. and for the reasons Representative Richardson described. But this is something that is, it's not about a political push and pull. It should be about evidence. It should be about science and access to care. And those are really the issues that need to be addressed, not a political battle.
Other comments? I would like to comment as well. I really agree very much with what Representative Maher just said. In the last session, I opposed this because we had both this and a bill for for advanced practice nurses, and my sense is, well, what are the criteria? What differentiates somebody that prescribed from somebody that didn't prescribe? And, you know, I sought for a general rule that would say, you check these four things and then it's a yes, or you don't check these four things and it's a no. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to find anything like that. So we end up right now, and I think I'll support that bill that's coming over, Senator Cruz's bill. I had to look at the general principles of expanding scope of practice, although it depends on how you do it, and I think there's some questions there. But this is one that seems to me, when I think about it, worth supporting this year, and it is a problem. Every single psychiatrist said no, and every single psychologist except one said yes, and it really did seem like it wasn't a battle of substance, it was a battle of, you're not a doctor, you don't get to do this. Psychiatry is the one field in the state that's actually losing numbers. We are having fewer psychiatrists available each year, and it's a real problem. So what's happening now is the psychologists are taking care of patients frequently. They'll just call a pediatrician and say, well, or the primary care doctor and say, well, I think the patient needs this, and you're dealing with probably neither of them that know very much about what's going on frequently in terms of these complex psychotropic drugs. I think it would be a lot better if we had some folks who knew something, and I think I'm convinced that under the model that Representative Kotek worked out, it's safe, and I'm going to be a yes at this time. So I'm ready for a bill. Did we amend it in the subcommittee?
Yes, we did, Mr. Chair. So
it's all set to go.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2800A. To the floor with a do pass recommendation.
As a matter of the do pass recommendation.
I move House Bill 2800A. Yeah, it is. Well, it's 2800 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation for the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
By prior reference. Well, that's a very clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
Motion. Is there a discussion on the motion? Did we lose Representative Gelson?
No.
The discussion had enough discussion? All right. Please call the roll.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes, and HB 2800 is moved to Ways and Means. The new pass recommendation is moved to the floor. New pass recommendation, and then on to Ways and Means. Good luck in your journey.
Mr. Bill.
We send you off.
We'll close the work session at HB 2800. We'll open the work session on HB 3088. We have a couple of folks to come and talk to us. We've been working very hard to try and get a consensus bill on this between the proponents of the bill and the Hospital Association, who's worried about it. where we are, we can get somebody to come and tell us, but where we are, I think, is very, is we're very close, but we're running out of time. And my recommendation to the committee is we adopt the dash four amendments, which essentially divides it into two. It was two parts anyway. The amendments basically take out section six onward and leave only the part about the charges. I think the proponent, I met with them this morning, I think they're pretty close. My recommendation is we amend it with the dash fours, put on the record here that we hope they will continue talking to each other and that we can get a consensus version in the Senate. I think we are close enough to move it. I'll carry this on to the floor if we pass it and put that on the record and the floor as well. Oh, this is going to revenue for... Why in the heck is it going to revenue?
So that Representative Bruin and I can spread further information about it to our colleagues.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, the original bill established a revenue fund. The amendments have taken it out, and Ways and Means of Revenue have not had a chance to look at the amendments to then ascertain any sort of a revision of the references, the subsequent referrals that have been placed on the bill, because the bill came to us with a revenue and a Ways and Means referral. So, but you are correct as far as our timeline, because even in trying to get them to get this, for us to get permission to send this, we really don't have the, you know, we're not afforded that time at this time to try and do that also.
It has both a revenue and Ways and Means.
And a Ways and Means, because of the original language.
Do you think if we hold it till Monday, we can get those rescinded between now and Monday?
We can, miracles do happen, Mr. Chair.
Could it happen on the floor, Mr. Chair? Could we do it on the, could it happen on the floor?
It can't get on the floor. It can't get to the floor if it has those referrals. So
procedurally, we need to get prior permission from the speaker to okay any resends.
So what about subject to?
Subject to.
Pass the bill subject to the speaker's permission to resend.
And
aspects that would
cause a always a possibility. You know, that's not a normal behavior, but that is correct. And just as a footnote, let's
do this, because we wouldn't want to do anything that was abnormal. Why don't we get the amendment on it today and hold it over till Monday
and see what we can do.
And I'll see if on Monday morning I can get them rescinded, because. There was really, and the answer might be no, but I'll try it. And Representative Florence?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. Now, I have a Hannah Gross with dash one amendment, so that you obviously adopted the dash one amendment in the...
Is that in Gross with the dash one or the dash fours?
No.
Mine indicates Hannah Gross with dash one amendment.
And, Mr. Chair, you did, Representative Cannon moved the dash ones on Wednesday.
What are the dash
ones? Even though we... move the bill to the full committee without recommendation, it did come with the dash one amendments on it.
Okay.
So the dash fours would be...
What do the dash fours do that the dash ones didn't do?
The dash ones... the hand and gross, Mr. Chair.
I think the fours supersede the ones.
Part of it is incorporated. I did a very quick hand and gross.
I'm sorry, there aren't any fours.
Yes, the fours are from today. Mr. Chair, would you like me to just walk through a quick comparison? Okay. The dash ones do the same thing as the dash four on line one of the dash four amendments. It deletes provisions, ORSs, and the first two lines of the bill. The dash ones and fours also delete page 2, lines 16 through 45, so sections 6, 7, 8, and 9 are deleted from both amendments. What the dash ones do are then delete the entire page 3 and entire page 4. But the dash 4 amendments do not go that far. The dash 4s just delete on page 3, lines 1 through 23, maintaining section on that bill, Section 10, but being renumbered in the 4 to Section 6, restores lines 24 through 45. So in the dash 4s, that's back in the bill.
Question?
I was just going to finish.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And then also on page 4, where the dash 1s deleted that entire page, the only thing the dash 4s delete are lines 5 and 6, restoring section 14. So it's, you are technically, mm-hmm. even though you adopted the 1s,
yeah.
if you adopt the 4s, the 4s will lay over the 1s, but then you restore some of that, the subject
the
matter of the original
of the hospital,
bill.
For example.
Correct.
And an effective date, it looks like.
Effective.
Oh, the actual, correct. Correct. I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Probably, Representative Bonamici, you still have a question?
Just for clarification, if we adopt the dash 4s, does that do we have to rescind the dash 1s if we want to restore that material? Did
what,
I get that procedurally?
What we would do is...
I think we do.
Well...
Because there isn't any way to get the material back
in. What we would do is adopt, since you've adopted the dash 1s, we would send both the 4s and the 1s down to council and ask them to marry them so the parts that are duplicative...
I don't think so. Yeah.
And then they would tell us if there was a conflict.
Mr. Chair?
I think we ought to rescind the dash 1s.
And you can make a motion that the 1s replace the 1s.
Make a motion for the dash 4s to replace the dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, we faced this issue in another committee and legislative council. Counseled us to rescind, to actually make two motions, a motion to rescind the initial ones and then to...
That's what I think is the thing to do.
Mr. Chair,
I
believe there was a discussion about Section 5 on page
2. There was a discussion about Section 5, but we never got anything on that. So at the moment, Section 5 is still in there, and I think Section 5 needs to be a part of the discussion between the parties.
So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, you'd like us to clean it up and then we potentially see this back on Monday?
No. What I'd like you to do is to rescind the dash 1s and then get the dash 4s and set it to the floor.
Thank you for the clarification.
And with clear understanding that there's still negotiation going on, but we've run out of time.
No, but it was a revenue speaker's approval since it was...
Well, no, I would say let's do that and then let's hold it over till Monday.
Okay, so... You were
but
right.
So but Senator Pittsburgh, the notion is the Senator Pittsburgh. But I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
We got it.
Mr. Chair, I move that we rescind the Dash 1 amendments for House Bill 3088.
Is there any discussion on that?
Yeah.
Let's call the roll.
Just on the rescission of Dash 1s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
This is complicated enough, so it's probably better to put it on the record. Please.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Aye. The motion on the floor is no.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we amend House Bill 3088 with the dash 4 amendments.
Is there any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair, not having sat on the Access Committee, I just have not had a chance to really go through all of the material. I wondered if somebody could just give us a brief explanation of what kind of opposition you had, how far you got in getting to this point, and if we take out, according to the Dash 4 amendments, those sections, were those the sections that were causing controversy? Because it still seems like a big step to...
I'm carrying this, so I'll be happy to do that for you.
Thank you.
To the best of my ability. The bill had two major parts. The first major part in Section 1 through 5, and the second major part in mostly Section 6 through 14. There were some innocuous ones. The first part did this. The first part established a statewide policy for hospitals as to what they could charge uninsured people when they come to the hospital. The second was a complex bit of business that attempted to limit the margin that a hospital could have, the nonprofit hospital, the Erie Mosbury Hospital. The there was absolute opposition to the second part, and it seemed sensible to divide the question at least into two parts. And the purpose of the Amendment 1 and now the Amendment 4 has the same purpose. All it does is remove the second part. Now, the first part, there's been a bunch of discussion, and it has the SEIU on one side, who are the proponents, and the Hospital Association on the other, and we've been working back and forth, not with disagreement about whether a hospital, whether the hospitals ought to have a kind of standardized policy on if I'm uninsured and I'm going to come and I want to pay my bill. Nobody thinks I should be paying the rack rate. They think I should be paying something else. And the hospitals don't seriously disagree with the idea. But what they have been objecting to is the nature of the amount that should be discounted or how it ought to be determined. And it's complicated by the fact that two hospital systems had had a legal settlement on this issue. There were suits against both hospitals, and they came up with a legal settlement, one that I believe expires in 1 year and one that expires in 3 years. So there was some question about how this might interfere with the hospital's obligations under the settlement. So I think, as of this morning, I think we were pretty close to get the language that would satisfy both parties. And it's not a whole lot far away from the Section 1 through 5 as it now stands. And I think in the Senate they can straighten it out. But I'm willing to support it even as it is right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record as we were having this discussion, I appreciated sitting in on the healthcare access sub the other day when you heard this bill, and there was a proposed amendment at that time that had a couple of options for figuring what that rate would be, and one of the two options was that a hospital couldn't charge any more than 85% of what their rack rate was or their billed charge. And I went away that night thinking about how that pointed directly at what the issue really is. Because if we move forward and say, okay, insurers are going to pay this percent of what it costs, and Medicaid and Medicare is going to pay this percent, and then uninsured people are going to pay this percent, it all points back at the problem that we don't have a price for services for health care. And I think what this is trying to get at is no matter what our source of payment is, we should all be paying the same. The hospital should expect the same level of reimbursement whether they're providing care for you or for me. Right now, this is happening on the backs of uninsured people who are paying more than anybody else. But I hope that in the larger topic of healthcare reform, someday we can get to the place where we have a pricing system that makes sense and we actually know what it is that healthcare costs.
We did, you remember, pass a bill, which I think does some of that. It talks about requiring them to report on their community benefit things on a cost basis rather than on a
right.
on that wacky charge thing. I think it is important for them to be able to come up with a price that makes some sense. And Medicare is something like 87% of costs, and the insurance rates are something like 120% of costs or 125% of costs. So in some sense, it seems very appropriate that people without insurance certainly shouldn't pay any more than the insurance companies are paying for it. And I think that's where we're somewhere between that Medicare rate and one insurer, an average of insurers, something like that, I think we need.
Or Mr. Chair, just a price. I think about all the conversations that we have, one of the problems that the providers have is that we under reimburse them for care for people that are on public programs, and we just get into this cycle of shifting. And if we understood what costs were, and as a state government, state and federal government owned up to our responsibility to reimburse it at levels that it's just this endless cycle around what does healthcare really cost. And until we understand that, I don't know how we can bring costs down, since we don't know what the costs are.
Well, actually, we do know what the costs are, but we don't know what the charges are. The costs are determined. You can find the costs in hospitals by looking at the Medicare cost report. The question is, what are the charges? And that's the problem. Senator Bonamici, you had another question.
I'm going to withdraw it. Thanks.
Okay. Senator Mara.
Thank you. First off, I don't believe that the hospitals are fully on board. I think there's a long ways to go. I think Representative Gelser's comment about it'd be nice to be able to charge everybody just the same price for the service they receive, which is absolutely correct, but that's not the reality. And we've created this mirage of a system of what we pay for and how we pay for it and what we charge, which doesn't mean anything, and why do we charge that? I don't know. But it's not the uninsured that caused the problem. It's the government reimbursement of services that people provide for these groups of people, Medicare and Medicaid. And I mean, that's really, in my opinion, the crux of the problem. And I will not be supportive as it's proposed. I mean, if they can get to a place where they agree, then great. But currently, I don't feel like it's ready to move on. So that's why I will be a no vote.
I guess we're discussing.
Sorry.
No, it's great.
We have the dashboards on the table.
The dashboards are on the table.
Yeah.
The dashboards are off the
table.
The dashboards are off the table. Where are the dashboards?
There's a motion on the floor.
On the floor. Yes.
You said the ones were on the floor.
I mean, this is a good time to discuss this, any. All right, we have a motion on the dashboards.
Yeah.
Let's have a roll call on the floor.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And we'll hold this over till Monday.
Okay.
And you don't have to bring your pajamas on Monday, incidentally, because we need to be out of the room before 6 o'clock. So.
I get to stay.
So you get to stay.
You do.
Who's stealing this room for us at 6 o'clock?
Consumer protection.
Ah, okay. I will close the work session on HB 3088. Sandy, if you can help me Monday morning,
talk to people and see.
And if not, we'll send it on to those two places. What are you proposing?
No, I'm just pointing us.
Okay. Close that work session, didn't it?
Yes.
3 weeks. I'm going to open a work session on HB 2648. We will have in front of us the dash threes. So, Gardner, would you come up and talk to us about the dash threes?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm here today representing PhRMA. At your request, Mr. Chair, we went through this bill and went through also the PhRMA code and the HHS Inspector General's guidance and attempted to capture the essence of those very lengthy documents in a fairly short and abbreviated form. And to render a set of amendments based upon your own excellent suggestions with regard to particularly items which have a speech content and which, pursuant to the testimony that I offered earlier, I had concerns under Article 1, Section 8 about. And the result is what you see before us. It's a document that Pharma does not object to. I can't say that we'd probably in our dreams would prefer to have no bill at all. Would prefer to have the free market regulate itself. But we understand that it is the desire of this body to have a bill, and if that is the case, we wanted to have one that pursuant to your desire, Mr. Chairman, as closely mirrors the code, both the Inspector General's guidelines and the Pharma Code, insofar as possible. So that's what we've worked with you to try to do.
I really appreciate your work. We've already adopted the ones and twos, right? And you built the threes on the basis of...
Mr. Chair, I believe that the... I might get a little bit confused here. I think that the... And perhaps Sandy can help me if I get confused. That the twos are the OHSU amendments.
Right. It's a very trivial amendment.
Yeah. And I think
it was to exclude them.
Right. And I think that the ones were a kind of precursor version of the threes, if I'm not mistaken.
I think the threes
Supersede, if you will.
But they'll amend them. They'll modify them.
I think that's correct. Yeah. So what you would have at the end of the day would be the twos and the threes. I think in the A and Gross bill.
Yep. Jim, thank you very much for your work on this. I appreciate that.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Just if you could bring me up to speed, is the rationale for exempting the OHSU fellows and employees?
No, it isn't exempting them. It adds fellows. After residence on line 13 of page 1, it inserts fellows or employees of OHSU as well as residents, because they're not removed from this. It's just that allows pharma to deal with a slightly larger population.
Mr. Chair, Section 1, Subsection 2 on line 8 begins with the prohibition under Subsection 1 of this section does not apply to.
It means that they can give.
Correct. And the dash
to.
And the dash 2 amendments adds the OHSU language to read scholarships or other support for medical students, residents, or fellows to attend educational, scientific, or policymaking conferences of a national, regional medical specialty or other professional association, including but not limited to conferences that satisfy continuing ed. That is where, on line 13, that is where the OHSU adds the fellows or employees of Oregon Health Sciences as allowed by conflict of interest policies of the university, because they already have a policy in place about banning pharmaceutical manufacturers and direct marketing from representatives. I mean, they have a policy.
So this is to allow pharmaceutical manufacturers to sponsor residents and fellows to go to, like, the cardiology meetings and things like that, not to it's just sort of altruistic. Rather than sending them off to meetings where they brainwash them specifically, right, Jim? Yeah.
And Jim could maybe speak to that.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure procedurally that we're okay in terms of whether or not, and I'm not the parliamentary expert, but as Sandy is, that whether or not you need technically to rescind the motion by which you adopted the ones and then adopt the twos and threes. Because you have a bill in your possession which now was amended by the ones
and the twos
and so I'm just wondering whether or not you might need to rescind the motion by which you adopted the ones and then in place of that adopt the threes, just so you have a clean parliamentary trail.
You use the threes off the original bill.
They're exactly so. That's the issue. They're off of the original bill.
Mr. Chair, it looks like the ones are incorporated in the twos.
In the twos?
In the threes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, they are, but they're modified.
Sort of, okay. Yeah.
So that was just my concern. That
I think that's the correct thing to do, is to rescind the ones. We have the twos.
Yes.
And just as we did it in the other one, I think that's the thing to do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move to rescind the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2648.
That's great. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objections to that motion? The Dash 1s are rescinded.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2648.
We have a motion to add the Dash 3 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved. So done. This has a subsequent to Ways and Means. How did that happen?
Magic.
All right, let's talk about this one too then. Let's close the work session right now. We have the earlier one resolved. We can go back and deal with that in a moment. Let's close the work session, hold it over till Monday, and let's try this one. Sandy, you have some information. You have a suggestion on for us from the Speaker's office on 3088, is that right?
That is right, Mr. Chair. The Speaker's office, listening in as they do and being
good. Well, maybe properly, look at this
properly,
one too.
Properly coached by interested parties in the audience. The Speaker's office is more than willing to rescind the revenue and ways and means referral on 30088 with a subsequent referral to rules.
And then we can work on it. That could take care of and keep working on it in rules and see if we can get it back in another form. That's great.
Rescinding the referral to ways and means, but
and
not
revenue.
Rescinding the referral to rules.
Excuse me?
But it will go to rules.
Correct.
It'll rescind the
revenue and ways and means.
Revenue and ways and means. So we'll pass it, rescinding the revenue and ways and means referral, but adding a referral to the Rules Committee.
Correct.
Does that meet with everybody's approval? Can I have somebody try and craft a motion to that?
Mr. Chair.
Wait a minute. I need to open a work session on HB 3088.
Mr. Chair, I would
give it a shot.
House Bill 3088, as amended, to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation.
No, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rescinding the referral.
Rescinding the
pending.
Well, is it rescinded or not?
No, you're going to rescind.
Part of what we do is first rescind it from the other two.
Right.
But pending the approval of the Speaker's office, do you have it in writing? Do you want to make?
Well, we don't have it in writing, but if not, they'll just can it when it gets to them anyway. We have verbal approval of that.
Representative Richardson's going to give it a shot. I think he knows what's
about. If we first, I make a motion that we rescind the subsequent referral to the rules to the Revenue Committee and Ways and Means Committee.
By prior reference.
Okay, good. So moved.
No, pending the rescinding.
All right.
Did everybody hear the motion that Representative Richardson?
Could you repeat that, Representative?
Okay, we have a question. But
we're going to get Ramona here in a minute if we're
yes,
not.
Yes, she will.
I think unless we get another air raid attack and have to duck under the desk like we did this morning, we did it our first meeting.
I did it virtually rather than actually.
Well, good for you.
I
hope they cut the cameras at the same time. We don't have the authority to remove the rescission to or rescind the referral to Ways and Means and Revenue. If the verbal authority of the Speaker is great, that's fine. I mean, it's okay. That's fine, but. Pending, I've seen all of the rescissions been approved in writing, so I would suggest that you say pending the approval of the Speaker, rescinding the referral.
We actually can, we can rescind it. It goes to the Speaker's desk and they do whatever they want with it.
Do we have the authority to rescind
it? Yeah, I think we can make any motion we want. It's not binding on the Speaker. And when we pass a bill, however we pass it, it goes to the Speaker's desk. And the Speaker's desk then disposes of it at that point. But I think
I'd be happy to amend the motion. Subject to the approval of the Speaker, we would rescind the subsequent referrals to the Committee on Revenue and Ways and Means.
There you go.
We have a motion to rescind the two prior referrals. Pending the approval of the Speaker. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In street speak, we're sending it to rules.
Yeah, in a minute.
Okay.
In a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where we're going with it. That's where we've been instructed to send it.
Mr. Chair, we're just talking about the motion to change where to go to rules, not the actual bill itself. To
that's correct. Pass. I'm not okay. talking the bill itself.
Correct.
Is there any objection to that motion? So moved. Now let's have one to move it to rules.
Right.
Pending the approval of the Speaker, which we also need.
Mr. Speaker, I moved that.
Fortunately, it's not Mr. Speaker. Not this week. Other weeks, but not this week.
What's the number of this bill?
3088.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move 3088 to the floor with a subsequent referral to rules subject to the approval of the Speaker.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay. Is there any objection?
Comment?
Well, wait a minute. Then this will be the main bill.
Yeah.
So let's have discussion on this one. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Representative Maurer's comments earlier on this when he said it's not the uninsured's fault. I would take it one step further on this issue. It's also not the hospital's fault. It is the government's fault in the reimbursement. And so I have some problems that Representative Maurer addressed when we try to sort of force the solution that's our problem onto the hospitals. I'm going to vote yes on this because I know that some great work has been done, and I'm hopeful that in the Rules Committee it'll be fixed, but I wanted to put on record that I retain my right to vote no on the House floor if it doesn't get fixed. Just wanted to put that on record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I just want to say for the record that I believe it's our responsibility to raise the revenue to increase the reimbursement rates in the programs that might be causing the problem. I just want to say that.
Well, Medicare is a separate problem.
Well, but I know we're also talking about Medicaid rates.
The Medicaid, the Medicare rate's something like 65, 68% of the actual cost. That's a big problem.
Mr. Chair, it's the chicken before the egg, and I would suggest that we should do some serious health care reform before we start going out looking for new dollars.
I'll drink to that one.
Serve them up, Charles.
I need an excuse.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify my previous remarks, and I agree with the other comments that have been made that I don't think that this is an issue necessarily of fault, though I do agree with Representative Kotek that I don't believe that we adequately reimburse, and I think ultimately that becomes an issue of revenue. But I think right now, regardless of whose fault it is, we are unfairly placing the burden upon those who have the least ability to shoulder that burden, and those are the people that are uninsured. And as I shared with you the other day, I know that there was some testimony that was offered to the Access Committee that said that it's a myth that this is a problem because uninsured people don't pay anyway. That isn't true. There are many people who don't have insurance that are very committed to paying their bills and to meeting their financial obligations, and those people end up saddled with the burden of the deficits of our healthcare system. So I will be supporting this. I don't think it's the end of the conversation. I think it's a stopgap measure to protect those who are uninsured from bearing a burden that belongs to all of us as we move along towards a comprehensive health reform that involves adequate financing, adequate organization, adequate access. Obviously, it's a much bigger question that we can't solve in a single session.
All right. We have a motion before us to move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to rules pending the approval of the Speaker on that motion. And would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion passes, and the bill is on its way to the Speaker's desk for moving to rules. Let's see. Yeah, and don't let's forget to try and deal with the. Well,
you want to get the referral on, correct?
Yes. We're going to work session on HB 2733. We have some amendments to that as well. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this came from you.
Well, I think I can't find it. 2733 really next?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll consult.
And I think Janine Smith is here, but I don't know if that's for this one, if that's what you asked.
No, I don't think she's here for this one.
Okay.
What amendments are we?
We have the dash threes before, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I can't find it.
I have that.
Good. Here's where we are. Sandy, why don't you tell us where we are?
I'll do my best.
You probably know better
chair.
Than I do. On 2733.
Well, I found the threes. Okay. House Bill 2733, we had two hearings in the Access Subcommittee, Mr. Chair, public hearing in February, and then another one in March. This requires covered entities to report annually on system safeguards for protecting confidentiality of individually identifiable health information. We heard from the hospitals. We heard from DCBS, Joel Aereo, on the concept of the bill and the support for the concept, but that the bill in its original form was a bit problematic. And, Mr. Chair, that is about all the insight I have on this bill as to where I didn't work on any of the amendment language. And I believe the dash threes kind of just showed up today. like so many of them do. I apologize, committee. I'm feeling a little like not in control.
Who proposed it? I proposed it. And let me just comment on that. This is a I had the impression, I want to say this very carefully, that the initial response to one of the hospital systems losing 300,000 medical records or something, that while the system took it very, very seriously and did a great job in reacting to it and spent a ton of money reacting to it, my reaction was that the very first reaction of the CEO was, hey, somebody screwed up and we're going to find out who it was and we're going to take care of it. That quickly, I think, moved to, you know, I thought the system did an extraordinarily responsible job of doing what they needed to do to deal with what was an inadvertent mess. But what it's struck me is I've been working with Sarbanes-Oxley, or the foundation that I'm doing, where I thought we did a really useful thing in getting CEOs and chief financial officers of corporations to take responsibility for the financial reports of the corporations. I thought it does make a difference when a CEO signs that and says, I'm putting my reputation behind this financial report. What this attempts to do is two things. One, it gets organizations with sensitive health data to report on their systems for safeguarding. You should report that they have adequate safeguards to protect that personal data. And it gets the CEO and perhaps other organization officials to sign that, to take personal responsibility that they've reviewed that the safeguards of their organization. It has the health insurance companies reporting this as a part of their regular reports to DCBS, and it has hospitals and hospital systems reporting this as a part of what they regularly report to DHS. And we are pretty close to agreement. I'm going to ask some of the hospital folks to come up and tell us what they think about this.
Mr. Chair, were the Dash 1 amendments already adopted? I missed that part.
Madam Administrator, have we adopted any amendments this year?
No, Mr. Chair, we have not.
I have an engrossed.
I think the three has all of them, I think.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The difference between the dash 3 and the dash 1 from my quick reading is that the dash 3 is essentially the same, except the report is filed with the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research rather than DCBS, and rather than this the penalty provision being the non-reissuance of the license for the healthcare facility that fails to comply.
Which was very draconian.
The penalty in the dash 3s is a $500, a civil penalty not to exceed $500. I believe those are the only two differences between the two.
Gentlemen, would you comment for us?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I think Representative Cannon has given you an accurate overview of the amendments proposed on the bill. We certainly believe that the Dash 3 amendments are a preferable approach, but we still have questions about the bill itself and at least the technical provisions in the bill, whether the bill is ready to move as it is. This is an important issue. It's an important issue that the Senate has addressed extensively through Senate Bill 583, which is moving along through the process. House Bill 2733 takes a somewhat different approach in requiring an acknowledgement and a certification of the security of the information systems that a healthcare facility will use. They're not necessarily conflicting, but there is some overlap between the two approaches. I think it is fair to say that Senate Bill 583, which is the product of a work group that met throughout the interim, is a more developed approach to this issue than House Bill 2733, particularly given the amendments proposed to the bill, which we've just seen today. The specific concern I have with the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2733 are on page 2 of the amendment, starting on line 5, where there's a requirement that there be a disclosure of any breaches of the security of individually identifiable health information, whether material or not. That seems like a pretty wide standard for disclosure. And then it adds that involve management staff or employees of the facility who have a significant role. So it's a very broad requirement for disclosure, which is then subsequently modified as to who the participants are and what their role is in record-keeping systems. That one provision is, frankly, the most troubling part of the proposed amendment, just because of its scope and uncertainty. And in that specific regard, we have not had an opportunity to have a discussion about what those terms mean, how they would be applied, what the requirements would be, and ultimately, you know, whether a $500 fine is warranted for a violation of that provision. With that subsection, I think it presents a real problem in the bill as presented to you. The other provisions about acknowledging the security of the information systems and the disclosure seem less objectionable. That provision specifically does create a lot of concerns in our mind about the compliance with it. We're not absolutely adamantly ever forevermore opposed to the bill, but that does raise a significant concern for us on this Friday afternoon.
I'll offer strong support.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum, representing Providence Health System. I want to say, first of all, I thank you for the care with which you described your interest in this bill, Mr. Chair. We've talked about it several times. I also appreciate the amendment that you did authorize, the Dash 3 amendments, which changes the enforcement mechanism, at least making it, in some general sense, as I read it, proportional to other similar enforcement actions when there's failure to file a report. I do want to raise, for the record, two concerns, as I mentioned to you earlier, Mr. Chair, both of which conceivably could be resolved moving forward. First, on page 1, line 18 and beyond, a report is required that includes an assessment of the effectiveness of the insurer's or the facility's records security measures if this is a public report, and we believe it could be, under Oregon's public records law, not having vetted that question formally, but I presume it would be, the requirement could make such assessments, frankly, available to thieves, hackers, and therefore conceivably could achieve the reverse outcome of what I know, Mr. Chair, you and others intend. You could add more jeopardy to records retention as opposed to the reverse. Secondly, quickly, on page 2, starting at line 1 and beyond, the mandated disclosures there of, in the way described could provide conceivably a roadmap for litigation and through discovery. Attorneys could secure a copy of the written disclosures to the boards and auditors identifying significant deficiencies and security breaches. If you think that these are concerns that have been raised in the last day or so by attorneys for the system I represent, you're exactly right. You might know that they've spent a lot of time on this in the last months, if not year, I was encouraged to at least make these comments for the record, and I would say I'm not sure what the remedy is, other than to make sure the required reports, assessments, and declarations are in some way general and not awkwardly specific to achieve some reverse spin or reverse consequence. Another option might be to provide confidentiality protections for certain reports, which I know is a dicey proposition in this building on occasion. We do fully support, Mr. Chair, committee members, any efforts to protect records or respond assertively in the case of unfortunate security breaches. That's why we spent so much time in the interim leading up to this session, and in fact during the session, dealing with the consensus records protection bill, Senate Bill 583, and it will be heading here soon. And that's why we're taking some time to make these comments for the record today, and I appreciate your courtesy, Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 583 basically excludes the hospitals, right?
Mr. Chair, there is a way that
any organization that's covered by HIPAA from the provisions of that bill.
There is a procedure whereby there is an exception or an exemption for those who comply with HIPAA, and as Senate Bill 583 was considered on the Senate side in the Consumer Commerce Committee, I believe, along with the insurance industry, the hospital industry spent some time attesting to the virtue of that exemption from the standpoint of the rigor of the HIPAA process. We'd be pleased to submit for the record the document, the side-by-side document prepared, in fact, by a major insurer in Oregon that attested to the virtue of the rigor of the HIPAA protections. My only other comment would be that I don't think the hospitals approached 583 from the standpoint of wanting to be exempt from it. We, in fact, spent a lot of time trying to develop its processes, but felt there might be redundancy with the rigor of the HIPAA process. And, Mr. Chair, I know you've had some questions about that, and we'd be pleased to review that again with you in this context or other contexts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe both of you can help me with this question. It's my understanding that in Senate Bill 583, the hospitals are exempt from the record-keeping portion but not from the balance of the bill, which requires notification. Is that your understanding as well?
David, go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I believe that's the case. We believe, from a Providence Health System standpoint, that we are subject to the notice requirements whenever there is a breach of records. We, in fact, spent numbers of meetings with Senator Pruszanski and as many as 30 other people talking about notice requirements. The requirement, in fact, to notify individuals when their records are in jeopardy because of a breach, a theft, frankly, in our case. We believe we're subject to those. We believe relative to the safekeeping of records that we're also subject to and governed by HIPAA, the federal act. And so I think the answer to your question, short form, is yes. We believe we are subject to notice requirements, and the notice requirements in the legislation that's coming to you for your review, or at least your colleague's review, has specifications about both when notice is in fact required and how that notice is in fact given.
Yeah, that's not a subject of this bill, but I think you're right.
I understand, but it's a part of it because
this bill has to do with determining. My personal view of the situation is I don't believe HIPAA necessarily provides the proper record keeping safeguards.
And I think it's been proven that they don't. So this is, I mean, in addition to the notification requirements, I really believe it's useful to overlay some simply review of the systems. This doesn't add anything new in terms of security. It simply has to do with reporting that there are systems in place and certifying that the CEOs believe those systems are adequate. That's basically all this bill does. The rest is verbiage.
Mr. Chair, if I may, except, I believe, the provision on page 2, starting with line 5, which goes considerably beyond that in terms of requiring the disclosure and reporting of breaches. I don't believe that's just verbiage.
Do you think between now and Monday afternoon you can craft amendments that would satisfy your concerns about this?
Mr. Chair, I would.
I don't know anything what's going on in LC on Monday, so there's no assurance that anything will come out. But do you think you could draft something that could do LC that would meet your objections?
The objection I'm raising would require the deletion of lines 5 through 8 on page 2 of the amendment.
It's an easy amendment.
And Mr. Chair, the points I've made would require some definition of what's meant by certain words in this bill, which could achieve the unintended consequence of actually creating more jeopardy for records in one way or another than I know you intend. And by the way, we have no difficulty signing a declaration from our CEO that we take responsibility for the retention of records. That's not the issue for us, and if I didn't say that, I should have. So the point of your bill is not our concern. It's the verbiage. What's possible over a weekend heading into Monday is a really good question.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize not having been part of your subcommittee discussion on this, but you just stated that it is your belief that HIPAA does not provide adequate security for these records.
Now, let me say it in a different way.
Perhaps I misunderstood you.
No, I just may have miscommunicated. HIPAA has a lot to do with how people treat medical information. The piece of HIPAA, and I reviewed the document that they submitted, has to do with the regulations of the basic overall systems of an organization. I think HIPAA does a wonderful job of making sure a nurse doesn't spill information about an individual. HIPAA was really focused, and I went through the HIPAA training, on more than one occasion I went through the HIPAA training. It really focuses on what the system does with this individual medical record. How we make sure I don't call up and say your gonorrhea test came back positive and leave there's a message on the phone. I mean, it really is that kind of a, I mean, that's most of the training that I saw, and at the time I was a corporate officer in a healthcare system, was not around how you create the proper data systems and the security of those data systems. It was much more around these other kind of issues. If HIPAA does, then I see no problem with reporting. We have a HIPAA compliant system. We're convinced that it meets these records. We personally reviewed what the security system is and signed that. I mean, I we're not talking about what these reports need to be like.
Well, getting back to perhaps my original misunderstanding of your statement, what is your belief based upon or as evidenced by what that there is this problem with how they manage these records?
It was based on a data security system that secured 300,000 medical records as a backup by handing it to somebody and putting it in their car every night.
Gotcha.
That would not have been an appropriate data security system.
Mm-hmm.
When it blew, I think they did a lot to deal with that. 2 weeks after that hospital did that, a VA hospital had a very similar experience with having things in a PC that was in somebody's car that allowed access to several hundred thousand medical records.
I mean, that evidence to me was that, where is the security system here? I mean, you give it to somebody to take home in their car? And that's the main evidence that I have. Now, are things better now, what, 2.5 years later? Maybe they are, but I don't know they are. All I want them is to certify that they are. It seems perfectly reasonable to me. Tell us you got a great system and it's all right. And tell us if it's breached.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'll try to get off the dais here fairly soon.
Yes.
And I'm thinking out loud when I say this next thing, which is that sections 3 and 4, 1 and A achieve the objective, stop at line 17, and then catch the last paragraph with regard to the compliance. If that's the objective, to assure that executive officers of healthcare enterprises of whatever kind are assuring the procedures, that's not a problem for us. It's the further detail of what constitutes an assessment and report, deficiencies, et cetera. There are ways to do that, it seems to me, either before Monday or in relation to as a possibility, and not having thought about the implications of this amendments to 583, which has this body to go through yet. So, anyway. Thank you for your courtesy.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just for one final point, I would like to make sure the committee is aware that when this bill and these amendments talk about healthcare facility, that includes hospitals, but it is not limited to hospitals.
That's right. It's the definition of healthcare facility.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So then does this have the trickle-down effect to some of the couple of the other bills that we've dealt with to care facilities and so on that don't have big staff to do these administrative things?
I think that's Mr. Bishop's point. It includes nursing homes.
Thinking the clarification.
Among a number of other types of healthcare facilities, I think Mr. Fiskin may have the statute more accessible than I do, but the definition of healthcare facility is broader than just hospitals. Includes a number of other types of.
Representative Broom?
Oh, just a quick question. Would healthcare facility include like a one dentist office, as an example?
No.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
It would not.
It does not.
Okay, thank you.
Unless it's licensed as an ambulatory surgical center.
Thank you.
Final comment?
You don't need to.
I need to say final comment. We need to remove it.
I fully agree that there needs to be security and that there needs to be consequences when security is breached. I think it's a mistake for us as a body to start setting forth what it's going to contain, who it's going to go to, what the insurances are going to be, and all those things, because we'll miss something or there'll be unintended consequences from it. And I think that I personally am not in favor of this because I think it's too directive. It's micromanaging when we really want to focus on the result. And the result is we want to assure that there's success and that there's good security, that the top levels of management verify that there's good security and that there's responsibility if it's breached. But I think that to go beyond that is to get into realms that where there's unintended consequences or unintended burdens on facilities that may not be considering, even though it's sad that this has been breached a couple of times in two different facilities. There's lots of facilities, but the mere fact that there's been two breaches doesn't necessarily mean that we need to put a burden on everyone in a micromanaged way, in my opinion.
Well, as long as the breaches have made the front page, I expect there are breaches.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask a clarification to Mr. Fiskin, but then also ask Mr. Bishop, because Mr. Fiskin, you mentioned the possibility of amending 583 when it gets here, and I wondered if you had an active role in getting the exemption for healthcare facilities from 583, or did it just kind of come about, and are you willing to take that exemption out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I was among those involved in seeking the exemption in the course of what were at least 13 or 15 work group meetings led by DCBS, and Senator Pruzanski was there on many occasions. I believe the particular exemption at that time, if the exemption or exemption is the right word, was initiated by the Hospital Association with a rationale, and that we'd be happy to attest to the virtue of that rationale. So I think if the question is, are we as a hospital industry willing to agree to remove that, I think the answer is no. Are we willing to talk about it, justify it again, discuss it, show you the side-by-side comparisons of what's required in 583 and what's required in HIPAA? We'd be pleased to do that. So we're not trying to say just a hard no, but I think there's a rationale for the exemption that we would attest still holds today and is a good exemption in light of the character and the rigor of HIPAA. And again, it's a discussion we'd be pleased to have, so we're not trying to duck the discussion. We think the exemption makes sense.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, I'm not sure I would characterize it as an exemption. As I recall the provision, it says that a facility that is in compliance with HIPAA does not have to comply with duplicative state provisions.
Thank
but
you.
I don't believe it exempts them altogether. It's only when there's a when they are in compliance with HIPAA.
I thought it's Section 7 that had a one-sentence exemption, but I may have misremembered that.
Mr. Chair, the Insurance Division Administrator, I believe, is in the room, and he may be more familiar with it than I am. I did not believe it was an outright exemption.
Let's close this work session on HB 2733 and hold it open till hold it over till Monday, and we'll see whether we can get any further. Monday's going to be a tough day both here and in the LC's office, and I'm not sure what can happen at that point. The committee administrator has pointed out that 2648 does need to go to Ways and Means. There's this creation of a fund with a continuous appropriation, and it clearly needs Ways and Means. So I'm going to open up a reopen the work session on 2648 and accept a motion to move it to the floor with a new pass recommendation as amended with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2648 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate to have an amended motion and add to that with a withdrawal of the subsequent referral to rules?
That was a
different 2648.
Oh, 2648?
2648 wasn't the bill that we were looking for rules.
This
was the pharma bill that, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes, please.
After we adopted the Dash 3 amendments, there was a little alarm that this had a prior reference to Ways and Means, and so it was got carried over to Monday, and then it was brought to my attention that we have a continuous appropriation language in the bill that requires that it goes to Ways and Means, so we couldn't get a rescind. So then I shared that with the chair, and he reopened the work session.
Okay, I'm sorry. I went to the wrong annotation. I annotated this one as the one that was sent to rules after removing referral to revenue.
Do you
want
me to join them?
You did? Please. Come on.
Oh, geez. Anyone see a cell phone?
He's looking for his cell phone.
Oh, a cell phone. I made some calls. Is that yours?
We sold it.
What's the number? Can we call it?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the number? You want to call it?
You may want to stand at ease.
Oh, yeah. What's your number?
Of course, none of us have our cell phones on.
I don't
want to
stand at ease. I would wear your cell phone. Let's keep going.
Down where
we have a motion.
You wouldn't
have.
There is a motion on the table.
I have a comment.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we first heard this bill, and it was back in February, I'm looking at my notes, I had very, very deep concerns over it for a number of reasons, free speech not the least of which. I appreciate very much the fact that we have adopted an amendment which I think for the most part follows sort of the broad rules that pharma has sort of placed on themselves as sort of, hey, this is what we expect out of you. I still don't like this. And the reason I don't like this is because despite the fact that we've amended the bill to sort of make it a little more palatable, it still, in my mind, says we've got a big problem in healthcare, and you're a big part of that problem. it's an expense issue. It's a cost issue. And, yes, health care is expensive, and, yes, we know that pharmaceutical drugs are very expensive. But, Mr. Chair, I would say that because pharmaceutical drugs are very expensive, that's not necessarily the fault with our health care system. And I just use my, you know, am I a poster child for pharmaceuticals? Probably. I wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for pharmaceuticals on for one aspect, and for a different aspect of pharmaceuticals, I would be in a wheelchair, but I'm not. I climb mountains. And so I get a little, offended is not the right word, it's too strong, but I get a little concerned when pharmaceuticals are always pulled out as sort of the whipping boy for what's wrong with health care. Yeah, they advertise on TV. I realize that, and I realize there are some concerns with that, but so do doctors, lawyers, and politicians. And so I don't want to differentiate them for marketing. This is a free market capitalist society, and in my mind, free market businesses should have the right to, if they choose, to market how they want to market, so as long as it's within the rules of propriety. So I will be a no on this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Any other question? Any other discussion? Please call the roll, Aaron. You didn't find your cell phone yet?
Is it on buzz or is it?
Representative Bonney.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
No.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Gilson.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes, and it's on the way to Ways and Means. Work to do, huh? Well, let's just keep going to the order. We have HB 2953. Close a work session on 2648. Open a work session on 2953. And this... Yeah, there's somebody's not here.
Right.
This is a bill that came out of access. We didn't have time to formally act on it. But it is there are amendments. I'll be happy to talk about it because I helped create the amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may.
Please do.
Is it appropriate or inappropriate to declare conflicts during committee?
I'm sorry, is it what?
During committee votes.
Declare conflict in committee.
I think it's perfectly appropriate to declare a conflict during committee. If you would like to.
Is it required?
Is it required? I don't know the answer to that.
Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, it's not necessarily a requirement. It's not outlined in the rules, like chamber rules, et cetera, but
it's in Masons, and we follow Masons.
That is correct. And so it's encouraged, but it's generally under the purview of the member. We're not quite as strict in committee with governance of that as you are on the floor of the House.
Mr. Chair, I declare a conflict on House Bill 2648. My conflict is that I own and operate a medical practice.
You're not going to get any gifts, that's... You can still get all the books they want to send you.
And that wasn't a problem before.
That conflict is so noted. We have 2953 on the floor with a dash one amendment. If I can state correctly, and I'll be glad to hear somebody from the insurance industry if they have a problem, it does two things, the dash one amendments do. The lines 7 through 9 of the dash one amendments deal with a situation that right now the only radiological procedures that can be self-referred is mammography. This directs the Department of Human Services by rule to allow bone mass measurement to be self-referred. And then it does, in line 1 through 1 through 5, it it says to insurance companies, it doesn't produce new mandates, but what it says is, if insurance companies cover bone mass measurement by referral of a physician, then they need to cover it by self-referral under certain circumstances. And that's beginning at menopause for women and allowing retests every 5 years. And in line 16, it changes the self-referral option for men from men at age 75 to age 60, which means it would be one possible screening before Medicare kicks in, and then the Medicare rules are enforced. The bill in its original form made suggestions about Medicare, which, of course, we have no standing to do. So we heard testimony on access about how important this was in making sure people had access to bone mass screening, starting at menopause for women, starting at probably 60 or a little later for men. This adds these two pieces to that. Is there somebody from the insurance industry that would like to comment on this?
Oh, Mike Becker's here, sir.
Mike, do you want to talk about this?
And, Mr. Chair, I'm passing out some information that was handed to me in regard to some fiscal information as it relates to this bill that I'm passing out to the committee now.
Yeah, this is nuts.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, this information from OMIP was handed to me. For the record, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. What's been handed to the committee is information that I received today from OMIP, and Regents is the administrator for the OMIP program in Oregon. And you'll see a fiscal impact that's been computed by OMIP for the OMIP membership. And I don't know the basis on which this is computed, but with additional mandates and the promotion of the mandate, there is increased utilization. The actuaries will say that. So I think that's part of what goes into this, the increased utilization and promotion, and the fact that there is self-referral for the mandate. I do want to mention for the record that Regents, as well as most carriers, probably cover this under their current medical procedures. I'm not aware of denial of this this procedure, so I think it's more a function of the promotion.
No, I think the point is that it's covered now, but only on referral of physician. I think this own assume that this is a new coverage. That it's a mandate to cover these services where they weren't covered before.
Chair Greenlee,
I think it's not.
Yeah, Chair Greenlee, I think you might be correct that this computation was based on the original bill as introduced.
Let me see if I can ask this question carefully. If you do cover it now, as you said you think you cover it now, would the covering it on self-referral you didn't change your utilization very much in this case? Is it something that bothers you? I don't want to put you
in the spot. Yeah, Greenlee, it doesn't bother me in the sense that if there is a need for the service and it is medically necessary and appropriate, it should be covered. And what our medical directors tell us is that, in fact, we are covering it today.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, Chair.
Given given this fiscal impact statement, however incorrect it is, I think we have no choice but to move it to Ways and Means. I think, how about if we take a motion to amend it with a dash one amendment, put the dash one amendments in, and then send it to Ways and Means without a recommendation. Is that
Does that please?
I think we're going to kill it right now.
Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
You think it's a, well, then let's talk about the merits of it.
I can see it on TV now. Have you had your bone mass measured this week? We're going to see promotion for this to take place so that people can self-refer when they don't understand what they're doing and they won't understand what the results are. Then they have to call their doctor to read the results of a test that they may not have needed. And it's, this is not easy things. I think that we're trying to work ways to lessen costs for procedures that may not be needed, and it doesn't seem to me that this is something that everybody who reaches these ages has to have. And so it increases the cost of utilization based on advertising, not on medical referral. So I think that, personally, I don't think it's a good bill.
Mr. Chair, may I relay a story that my wife told me last week? And it was about a lady that received a bone density test. We're not quite sure where she went, what she got. And when she showed up at our office expecting us to see her in a visit and interpret the results for her because she paid for the bone density test, which was from some other place. And the reality is that that you get a result which is not interpretable by the layperson, and I consider myself a layperson, and it requires a professional to interpret the results, which is an additional cost to the system, to whoever's paying the bill, whether it's the insurance company. I view this as a mandate, and this is just not one I am willing to go down the road, because if it is medically necessary, then it's absolutely covered. Yes, ma'am.
Sorry, it's Friday. That was the funniest thing I've ever heard.
It's been a bad day.
It's a personal issue. excuse me, Mr. Carroll. No,
I'll get this together.
Okay, thank you. That was funny. What I think I heard Mr. Becker say is that Regents Blue Cross is already covering. I know personally when I've gone to my primary care, he has referred me for a bone density thing because I'm in the age group that needs that. It's covered under my insurance. And so where's the problem?
Oh, the problem has to do with the... let me see if I can recreate the testimony. This is one of the problems of having subcommittee. We had about an hour and a half of testimony on this. The question of osteoporosis in women, in postmenopausal women, is a serious problem and a very real problem. And furthermore, there are now ways to treat women with at risk after bone density measurements with both drugs and exercise that will reduce what will end up being the burden of disability at a later age. And it's a serious issue. It's a serious issue in women who are at risk particularly. And there are a set of risk factors that relate to the likelihood of this problem. Part of the problem is one of education, because in fact there are a lot of primary care physicians who don't move in the way they should in making sure the women are protected. And this is really analogous to the situation with mammography, whereby creating the ability to self-refer to mammograms, we've really done important things in reducing the seriousness of breast cancer, not the incidence of breast cancer, but making sure we get breast cancer at an early enough stage so something can happen. The intent here is to do two things. It's to allow self-referral, which currently is not allowed. And obviously with self-referral, the results would still have to go somewhere, just as they do with a mammogram. I mean, if you self-refer to a mammogram, somebody doesn't hand you the image and say, interpret it. They send the results to somebody that you have to specify. The same thing would be true here. And it's
I mean, it seems to me it's a serious public health issue.
Should we be training the doctors, primary care?
We should. Yeah, and we are trying to.
Continuing education.
Mr. Chair, can I give a brief example of why I support this bill? I, right at this very moment, do not have a primary care physician because every time I get one, she retires or moves or something. And I'm not taking that personally, but I'm also in this group. I should get a bone scan. I'm in this group. My mother has osteoporosis, and in order for my insurance to cover it, I have to go find a primary care and get referred and then go back to a primary care. I'd like to just call and get one and then have it sent to a clinic and get it read without having to take that extra step. So that's the way I see it. I should be able to make that decision to call and get this medical care that I should get without taking that initial step to have somebody tell me that I need to do it. That simple, in my opinion.
Well, we have to send it to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which only brings on a rhetorical question. Are we saving money by doing that? I mean, are we saving money by eliminating the primary care physician as part of the wholesale aspect? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't think we're saving money. I think what we're saving is disability. And we had the state's expert on osteoporosis. In fact, I'm a member of one of his studies. We're now studying osteoporosis in men, which we didn't do before, who really argued that being able to self-refer would make a huge difference in finding women who are at high risk and in beginning to treat them.
Mr. Chair, I also support this bill and would just, with your permission, like to take a wild stab at making a motion to adopt the -1 amendment.
It's not a wild stab, that's a motion.
It's a motion.
I have a motion on the floor to adopt the -1 amendments. Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? We have the -1 amendments. Do you want to put another motion on the floor, Representative Gelson?
With your permission, yes, I'd like to, and just in the interest of time, I know this is now moving quickly.
And we will have to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means with that fiscal impact statement.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2953 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
As amended.
Is there any more discussion of that amendment? Will you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Motion passes. And 2953 is on the way. Ways and Means. It would be useful if we had some discussion with OMIP on that.
New fiscal?
Well, I mean, it's got that fiscal, so there's no choice but to send it to Ways and Means. We'll see if we can get somebody to work it in Ways and Means. Time's getting late for some folks. We're going to start losing people, and I really would like to bring up... I want to bring up 3099. We're going to have a work session on 3099.
Mr. Chair, while everybody's getting to the right folder, on 3099, I'd like to acknowledge some testimony for the record. We have written testimony from Senator Alan Bates, Lindsanne Piercy, Roger Burt, John Thompson, April Love, Mel Cohen, and Jim Nielsen, that we would like to have that acknowledged for the record, and it should be in a packet that is behind other materials that you have on this bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I don't have enough material.
And I'm also going to pass out the...
Thank you. I'm not sure. I find the printed bill in the middle of this.
No.
Dennis, you have your printed bill handy? Well, here's three of mine.
I'm looking for this.
The which?
The city. When we took it, it's their amendment.
I don't want anybody. I don't want anybody this one.
You know the dash here?
The dash? Do we have dash
here? Yeah.
I don't have a written. I mean, I have it somewhere missing. You have a written version of the bill?
A clean copy of the bill?
Clean copy of the bill.
Yeah.
I
mean, none of us can find it.
It's just too much material here.
Yeah. Oh, this amendment does.
Sandy, you want to tell us what this amendment does?
Oh, sure.
What the dash two amendment
the
does?
The dash two amendments to 3099, Mr. Chair, if you will know.
Hold on. Hold on. Oh. We've lost some folks.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we still have a quorum.
No, I don't want a quorum. Mm-hmm. I want everybody to hear what we're doing. Okay. Can you tell us about the impact of the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash two amendments are very, very simple. They add one word to the bill on page 2, line 12, in the subsection 6, where it's specifying the requirement for a water supplier serving more than 10,000 persons from adding fluoride to drinking water until the department determines that the water supplier has funds sufficient to purchase the fluoridation equipment from a source other than fees. That's in current language. We're adding taxes or charges by the water supplier to the suppliers, ratepayers, shareholders, local taxpayers, or bondholders.
So this protects, this softens the mandate that says that if a water district can't get funds, not counting funds from fees or from taxes, then they don't need to, then they're not subject to the mandate.
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When a municipality looks for money, where else does it get money besides fees and taxes?
Grants, money from the state health department, other kinds of other kind of sources of funds.
The money free. Mr. Chair, I don't see the amendment here that does not make this a mandate on a community without their vote on the issue.
I'm sorry?
I don't see the amendment here that does not impose a mandate on people of a local community without their vote.
Is there an amendment like that?
We could do it by interlineation if that's your choice, Mr. Chair.
Really?
By which?
By interlineation. You know, by
interlineation.
By adding it to the line. Just go to the line where it's at and we just add a couple words.
You're talking about a conceptual amendment?
Yes. Same thing.
I think we're not going to have a conceptual amendment on this one at this time.
What was your suggestion, Representative Flores? I missed that.
My suggestion was that I'm not seeing an amendment that would not impose a mandate or not allow it to be a mandate on a local community without their vote on this issue.
We've had that's no discussion on that as a...
That's current law.
I mean, nobody has suggested that...
Well, it has been the subject of some conversations, Mr. Chair.
There's been a lot of conversations.
That specific element has been the subject of conversations, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, could we, before we go into that conversation, I'd like to move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3099.
All right, and the purpose of the dash two amendments is to say any municipality can say we don't have the money to do it, and therefore it becomes a non-mandate on them if they don't have the money to do it. So is there any discussion of the dash two amendments? Is there any objection to the dash two amendments? We have the dash two amendments. Now, I'd like a motion on the bill itself, please. Then we can discuss it.
Mr. Chair? I move House Bill 3099 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Yes.
Representative Malamichi.
Thank you. I have to find my piece of paper.
I talked about this in the subcommittee, and I'll make my points again. In the full committee, I acknowledge the need for more dental care and for greater access to dental care, especially with children. We've talked a lot in this committee and in the policy
subcommittee about health care access issues. I've supported every bill that expands health care for kids and every bill that deals with topical fluoride, and have supported those bills, especially support the expansion of school-based health clinics. And I believe that we need to do everything we can to make sure kids in this state have all the health care that they need. That being said, I'm concerned about House Bill 3099 for many reasons, starting with the preemption. There have been areas in the state, for example, in Portland, where people have said at least three times, I believe, that they don't want fluoride in their water. And I'm concerned about the people who don't want the fluoride when there are other alternatives, such as topical fluoride, available to them. Those alternatives exist. I would rather spend the money that it takes to get the system up and going and to fluoridate water on getting fluoride directly onto to the teeth of children and on expanding health care. I firmly believe that we need to respect the rights of people who don't want fluoride in their water, and I'm especially concerned about families with infants who might be mixing infant formula with fluoridated water in light of the recent warning from the Dental Association. There's no way to monitor how much water intake, especially with kids who drink very different amounts of water and adults. There was a concern raised about people who have kidney or thyroid problems not being able to take the fluoride that would be in any certain amount of water. People who don't want fluoride will have to get a reverse osmosis filter, which is not only a significant expense, but also takes, I believe, I understand, 4 to 5 times as much water, for example, 4 to 5 gallons of water to get 1 gallon of water without the fluoride. There are many questions raised about the health effects of fluoride. I know many on this committee vehemently disagree with those, but in my opinion, there's enough to raise a doubt that I can't feel comfortable supporting this as a mandate, and would instead encourage us again to spend our time and energy and money by improving dental care rather than putting fluoride in everyone's water.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank, maybe it was Dr. Love who prepared the questions from the last, in response to the last testimony that we heard, and I think these answer a lot of our questions, and I want to say thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a hard issue for me, like many on the committee, I suspect. I have something that I'll enter into the written testimony in order to save time so I don't have to fully explain myself out loud. I did write a letter to the chair that I will enter into the written testimony, but I want to just highlight a couple of parts of it. One of the points I make is that I find the scientific case against fluoride rather inconclusive at best, and I'm concerned, frankly, about some of the selective use of fluoride and evidence against fluoride and sort of misuse, and I think some sort of shaky grounds for some of the anti-fluoridation claims. At the same time, I find from reading the science that there's a lot of good reason to think that fluoride does benefit teeth. In fact, I think there's no doubt about that. I realized, I think, looking at all of this, looking at the science, talking to a lot of people about it, just how personal an issue this is for many Oregonians, how consumption into our bodies is really an issue of personal sort of integrity and personal decision. And my conclusion, while I don't find the scientific evidence against fluoride particularly compelling, I find the scientific evidence in favor of fluoride quite strong. My conclusion is that this decision, if it's made, ought to be made at the level of government that gives people the most opportunity to influence that outcome. And that means our local government should have that control and do have that control. So for that reason, primarily, I will be voting no. I go into additional sort of analysis of this. It's very difficult. Like Representative Bonamici, I am concerned, to say the least, about the incidence of dental decay in our children. It's an issue on which we have not done enough work as a government and as a society, and so I really do look forward to working with the committee on that.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just thank Senator Dr. Bates for the letter that he provided to us and the summary of the studies that have come out of Harvard and others, the American Dental Association, relating to fluoridated water and the danger it poses for infants under 1 year who are taking water mixed with their formula. And so I've read a lot, and I feel that there is a lot of evidence on both sides, but I would have to agree with Representative Cannon that this is a decision that people ought to make about their own water supplies and not have the state government saying that you really should do this just because there are those that think that that would be a smart thing for them to do.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. This, I would say that fluoride has been the great surprise of my first full legislative session. We've dealt with many topics that are concerning to a lot of people and very controversial, and I would not have guessed the degree to which fluoride would raise passions in people. I started the conversation strongly in favor of fluoridating the water. I come from a community that is fluoridated for a very long time, and I'm a longtime advocate for children's health. As we went through this process, I came to a point where I was unsure. I think I shared with the chair that I was considering voting no, and we continued to have hearings. But I've come back around to wanting to support this after very careful consideration for a couple of reasons. One, I've been contacted by every dentist in my community, and most every dentist that I've spoken with has described their experiences of being in communities where there are fluoridated and non-fluoridated communities that are nearby them, and their ability to know just by looking in the mouths of the children which part of the community they're coming from. And given the impact that poor dental health and tooth decay has on children, both socially and academically and medically, I don't want to give up an opportunity to help some of our poorest children that are out there. I struggled about the issues of the health impacts, and that's what really had left me teetering. But I kind of did a gut check and recognized that there was nothing that I heard that caused me to write a letter to my children's school and say that they couldn't drink water. I'm not concerned about my kids' health when they're at school drinking water. I've got two nieces, Eowyn and Enile, who live in the city of Corvallis. I don't, and that drink fluoridated water. One of them is a month old and does have tap water, I'm sure, mixed in with her formula on the rare occasions that she drinks formula. And I haven't felt compelled to call my sister-in-law and say, please stop, your infant, my niece, is at risk. I don't see that in the history of the health records in Corvallis. I've talked with the state epidemiologist. There are not increased rates of cancer or any of the other types of problems reported in Corvallis. So ultimately, I would rather err on the side of preventing tooth decay and tooth loss among children, recognizing that this is a very difficult issue, and I respect those that vote in a different way and share a different opinion than I do on this issue.
Thank you.
Senator Bruin? Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it very much. I won't repeat everything that's been said. I think Representative Cannon did a great job of sort of demonstrating in his letter here the differences in the science that will in the scientific background and the research background and the peer-reviewed research that we saw. We can make decisions based on that. There's no question that there were deep passions on all sides. I feel that passion in my particular district. The passion for has been particularly strong, not only from the dental community, as Representative Gelser mentioned, that was unanimous, but from the general constituency as well, and it was it's been not unanimously but heavily in favor of doing this. I take a little bit of solace in the fact, and I wasn't expecting these Dash 2 amendments. I didn't know they were here until here, but in my mind, the Dash 2 amendments make this a permissive bill rather than a mandate bill, and it's very creative language that gets us there. I've learned something today, but nevertheless, I know the passion is still there. I want to share one personal comment on this, and I realize that the committee hearing like this would generally not be the forum to raise an issue as banal as a campaign consideration, but I want to share one example. 2 years ago, my first session, in fact, it was about April of 2005, I wasn't on a healthcare committee, but this issue, as it has every session, came up, and I got home one night, and my wife, as she always does, asked me, you know, how was your day, honey? What did you talk about? And I said, well, you know, it's the big issue du jour is fluoridated water. And she goes, well, how do you feel about that? And I said, I made some comments. And she says, well, how are you going to vote on that? And I said, I did the same thing. I shrugged my shoulders. And she looked me dead square in the eye, Mr. Chair, and says, if you do not support fluoridation of water, I cannot support your reelection. This is my wife. And so it's important to understand that my wife is the daughter of a dentist and also worked 10 years for the OHSU School of Dentistry. So for that reason, it's a minor reason, but for other reasons, I will be a yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, let me make my statement first.
Oh, absolutely.
This is an issue that I've looked at for a long, long time, and I was really instructed by something Representative Bonamici said, and that was something about, I think it was an offhand remark about buying fluoridated toothpaste for all the poor people. It struck me this is, from a public health perspective, to a certain extent, a class question. And it really hit me very hard when I thought about it that way. My kids really didn't need fluoride in the water. Your kids really didn't need fluoride in the water. Those of us that are educated and have assets, our kids got plenty of fluoride. They got fluoride toothpaste. They got fluoride in the dentist. The dentist was painting with fluoride and charging us lots of money for it, and they got fluoride tablets, and they got fluoride. But, and incidentally, I think that's where that closing graphs for the difference between fluoridated and unfluoridated water is coming from. I think middle-class kids are getting taken care of. The problem is, how do you get this to poor kids? And from a public health perspective, we need to have a different approach to how you get to the poor kids, because they do not go to the dentist very often. They do not get fluoride tablets. They do not... Until they get into school, where we can get them when they're 6 or 7 years old, we can find a way to get some fluoride, and we've passed some bills that will help that. But that's very late for these poor kids to get fluoride. So everything that I know about public health says sometimes you just have to take mass measures in order to help subpopulations, and this seems to me to be a very important time. Representative Kopek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to withdraw my motion for the do-pass recommendation, and then I'd like to make a comment and make another motion. So.
Please.
So do I need to do more than that if I just withdraw my motion for a do-pass recommendation?
No, you can withdraw your motion. We haven't voted on it. And make your comment.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank everyone on the committee for, we've heard a lot of testimony. We've read a lot of materials. I think everyone's been incredibly thoughtful on this. Out of respect for that, I'd like to change my motion to move House Bill 3099 as amended to the floor without recommendation. I do think this is an important issue. I do think this is one of the premier things we can do for the health of every Oregonian this session. I think it's very important. I want to see it go to the floor. I want to make sure that we have a good debate about it, and so I want to change my motion to be without recommendation to the floor as amended.
Thank you. I think this does make sense. I think we ought to decide it on the floor rather than decide it in committee. It's an important motion. I've heard from the Senate leadership that if we get it out of the House, they would like to have it where they can be debating it in the Senate. And I'm certainly going to support that motion.
Can I make one more comment before we...
No, the floor is open. You can have any number of comments.
Thank you. I just wanted to add a couple points. First of all, Chair, I'm sure that my comment was not intended to be offhanded, even though you may have perceived it that way.
The toothpaste one was.
Right. I really believe that I do care about the health care and the dental care of especially low-income children.
Absolutely.
But I'm not sure that, in fact, I'm convinced that it's not a lack of fluoride. It's a lack of dental care and a lack of good nutrition that's causing dental problems, and that's where I'd like to put the emphasis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson?
I think that building on to Representative Bonamici's comments, if this conversation moves to the floor, I hope that we can recognize that this is an issue of weighing many complex spider-webbing issues, and it's not an issue of caring or not caring about children. I think that's
good. Well, we have a motion on the floor. If we've had enough debate on the motion, we have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 3099 to the floor without recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Bonamici.
No.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Kannon. Aye.
Representative
Flores. Absent.
Representative
Johnson.
Aye.
Representative
Bowen.
No.
Vice Chair
Fontaine.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Robinson. No. Chair Green. Aye. Motion passes. HB 3099 moves to the floor without recommendation.
Okay. I didn't do too well yesterday.
Can you carry it?
I'll carry it.
No, unless somebody favorable carry it. I think I'll carry it.
I can tell people about this bill.
Well, actually, we sent somebody a no vote to get a yes vote.
Thank you very much. This has really been a difficult issue. And Representative Bonamici, if I said anything that seemed to infer that you don't care about poor kids, I really want to apologize. I've known you long enough, and we've had this discussion long enough.
Years.
Years, in fact. A long, long time. I want to make sure that wasn't in the feeling.
Chair, is that sentiment directed this way, too?
I didn't. Is that bipartisan?
No, I'm not sure about that, about you, Mar.
You know, it really is important, as we're talking, Representative Maurer said, and said this yesterday on the floor, we're really talking about we need to be talking about serious health care reform, and we shouldn't have to worry about whether kids are getting dental care or they're not getting dental care. Somewhere along the line, I think we're going to solve that problem of fits and starts. It's very important. Okay. I know some people have to go, but if we could keep going a little more, I think that would be great. It'll save us time on as long as we have a.
Could you define a little more?
We've got three bills.
Yeah, and I think they're not controversial. Is that what we have? We have three bills left, and I think they're not controversial. I think.
This is probably the easiest.
We've got a quorum. So as long as we have a quorum, let's keep going.
You need to close your 39.
Close the work session on 3099.
Excuse.
Yes, you're excused. Thank you. Let's go to. Let me open a work session on HB 3501. We had this. This was pulled from Access. We were working on agreement between the parties on this. I hear we have agreement. Is that right?
It is correct, Mr.
And I hope we have an amendment that reflects that agreement.
We do. And
Ms. Phillips, you want to bring us up?
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, this was one bill that we did prepare well for. It had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We did get permission to rescind that, and I do have the notification of that.
Great.
Mr. Chair, I need to leave. 3501. Do you have enough people?
Wait a minute. Is Cannon coming back? 1, 2,
well,
three.
No, Cannon's left.
4, 5. Yeah, we have a.
Well, who's leaving? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
If you wanted to leave.
I got a grandma waiting to be relieved of duties, so.
I'll be quick.
Yeah. How about 15 minutes? Yeah, let's try and get a couple.
Do you need me to stay?
No. Yes. As long as we have a as long as we have a quorum, we're fine.
3, 4, 5.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3501 comes to you as a joint agreement of the Hospital Association and COHO, the managed care organizations. We would ask you to adopt Amendment 2, changes 75 to 80, corrects a grammar error of 1 to 2, and puts a sunset clause of January 2nd, 2010. Good bill should pass. Please support.
Are those the dash 2s?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
And for the record, my name is Paul Phillips.
Okay.
No.
Do you have a question?
No. Quick comment.
Comment.
I like the sunset. and because obviously it gives it a chance to work, and if it doesn't, he dies a glorious death.
You guys both did great. It was, I really appreciated you staying at it and getting to where you could all live with it. And I hope we do need to have hospitals in those networks. And you did a great job. I'll take a motion to amend 3501 with the dash twos.
Chair, I move House Bill. I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3501.
Of the dash two amendments.
The dash two amendments. Yes.
Any discussion? Any objection?
I just want to say thank you as well. This was the bill. This is actually a bill that I had submitted and wanted to step back and watch the managed plans and the hospitals work this out, and I'm pleased to see that you have worked it out. So thank you.
Thank you for your help.
We have a motion on the floor to adopt the dash twos. Any objection? Dash twos are adopted.
Question on dash one, were they moved in or did we leave it?
I don't think we
don't. We don't need the dash ones. The dash twos.
They took care of the more and less.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Because it deleted that portion of the line.
Okay.
Yeah, we're taking everything out. This is simply a flat 80%.
That is correct.
Yeah.
It reads at 80% of Medicare rate for the non-contracting hospital, period.
Move the bill.
Would you please call the roll on HB?
Mr. Chair?
Oh.
I'd like to move House Bill 3501 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Right. Is there any discussion on that? Please call the roll.
Senator Barney.
Excuse.
Senator Bruin.
Aye.
Senator Cameron.
Excuse.
Senator Flores.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Pro Tem. Aye. 3501 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think we put this on the consent calendar. Can I have a motion to that effect? I think we put this on the consent calendar.
Or does somebody want to carry it?
Because when you just read the bill, you wouldn't know whether there's an agreement or not agreement.
Yeah.
I'll carry it. Well, I've never carried a bill on a session.
Okay. Wow. There we go. We know who to give big stew to.
No.
Okay.
It's Representative Richards.
Representative Richards is going to carry us,
though, Dennis.
Sorry. Save that.
Okay.
So 80%.
Okay. Representative Maurer.
Yes.
You think we can do a quick on 3097?
Absolutely.
We're losing Trina. I'm sorry.
Okay. We still have, I think, we'll still have a...
Are you saying?
No, absolutely.
No, he's going
to... I'm here all night. I only have to drive to Grants Pass.
Let's get this bill, which has to go to Ways and Means anyway.
Okay.
Let me close the work session on 3501, open a work session on 3097, which came to us from Access and has a complete, it's a complete gut and stuff. It's the, which amendments?
Dash four.
Would you like to talk about the dash fours, Representative Mary? You're the carrier from Access.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's House Bill 3097 with the dash four amendment. And this is, let's see, Representative Bruin and Representative Flores were the ones not involved. This was the work of a group of people that was wide-ranging from hospitals to DHS, advocates, OPR, UPR, NIPR. They were all there. Anyway, I really enjoyed our chair's support and his backing of me being in the room, and I didn't do all the work. The heavy lifting was done by Oregon Nurses Association and Primary Care Healthcare, Primary Care Association, and he's not here. Anyway, this bill, in my opinion, is about a health care reform bill. This is about increasing access across the state for primary care and does a number of things that will be tested across the state. We can go, there's a lot of detail in this bill, but it creates 20 demonstration projects across Oregon using collaboratives that in many places exist, but it drives some other issues such as reimbursement for nursing services, encouraging school-based health clinics, requesting a waiver from CMS for EMTALA, which we probably should discuss on the Senate side because there may be some issues with that particular piece. Senate Bill 329 brought that up. I'm going to close there because we are running out of time. But this is a good bill. It should be asked. The question is whether there's the money. And that's why it's going to Ways and Means.
When I talked to the Ways and Means co-chair about this bill, the one time that got her eyes open that weren't open before was the fact that this is a one-time commitment. I mean, it will be $15 or $17 million. But it will really affect 20 communities. I became really committed to this idea listening to Representative Richardson and Representative Hanna in discussions we were having on another bill, pointing out that the problem in healthcare is sometimes just getting healthcare. And this will produce healthcare for people in a way that we can learn something in 20 communities around the state.
And if I may interrupt, it's not just 20 communities or towns, it's collaboratives. Like in Josephine, it's a Josephine-Jackson County collaborative, so we're talking, you know, a pretty wide range of geography and a significant number of people. So it's not just about 20 small communities.
Do we have a motion on the floor?
We do not.
Could we?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3097.
Is there any discussion on the Dash 4s? Any objection? We have the Dash 4 amendments of 3097, which creates a new bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3097 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Is there any discussion on that? Would you call the roll, please? Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. HB 3097 moves to Ways and Means. Thank you all very much for sticking in. Yes, you.
That committee, as we stand presently, I thought you might want to reconsider the vote on this one.
I think I'll just fill with what we have.
Okay.
But thank you for the good advice. thank you all for hanging in. I'm sorry.
We've got one more.
You want to do one more?
We have to do one more.
Having so much fun.
All right. Let's open a work session on HB 3094, which has dental service. Do we have any agreement on this bill yet? Nope. No agreement on the bill. Let's hold it over. Close the work session. Please.
No.
You want to put this on Monday then?
Talk about it on Monday. Yep.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't know.
Sorry
that.
To keep you here the whole time, guys.
I was here and then I don't know what happened.
Well, I think it's going to be a. It's going to be a pick up one side or the other on this one. Yeah, let's adjourn the Senate Committee on Healthcare and thank you all for hanging.